This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We know, you're an NPR listener. You like those really highbrow films. The Godfather, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, Citizen Kane. We also know that lurking within the soul of every fan of Scorsese are a few lower-budget loves. Maybe you never wore fishnets, but you know all the words to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Or you secretly cherish those lesser Oliver Stone movies. You profess a fondness for the tragedy of the 1986 version of The Fly, but truly love the original, decidedly B-list 1958 version. No, they don't make screams like that anymore. We're celebrating your lesser-known sub-mainstream cult hit favorites, all the femmes fatales, zombies, saloon singers, vampires, and pop stars, with the help of David Sterrett, the chairman of the National Society of Film Critics. He and co-editor John Anderson have brought them all together in their new collection of critical essays called The B-List, the National Society of Film Critics on the low-budget beauties, genre-bending mavericks, and cult classics we love. Later in the hour, historian James McPherson joins us with a long view of the war powers of the president. But first, they're coarse, they're chic, they're cults. What's your favorite low-budget B-list beaut? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. David Sterrett joins us from the studios of the production room in Santa Barbara, California. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
And by your own admission in the prologue to your book, it's an odd collection that marries Platoon and the Son of Kong.
Yeah, one of the things that we really wanted to do is to have a book, if possible, with something in there for virtually every taste. And I really think that we've done it. What this means, of course, is that the entire book won't please anyone, but even the hardest to please person is going to find something in there which rings a bell.
And let's start with some definitions. How do you define, in a world without double features anymore, a B-movie?
Stumps me.
We were going to talk about really, this for hours, but yeah. We're left speechless.
Exactly. Yeah, no, of course, the term originally did mean not just a movie that was like on a double feature, but back in the days of double features, it was a B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature. So this was kind of the orphan stepchild or something of the movie industry. And they were made on low budgets, and they were made usually without any kind of stars, even minor stars often stayed away from these. So they were really, the little product that wasn't really intended to mean very much. Nowadays, we don't have double features anymore, and we don't have drive-ins anymore, and the scene has changed. So we don't have B-movies in that technical sense, but we still do have the littler movies, the movies that not so much is invested in, and crucially, these lower-budget movies without stars and so forth that still get made all the time are the movies that allow for more experimentation, more risk-taking, more personal expression by directors and writers and all the creators in the industry, precisely because there's no big investment riding on them. You can take a chance without worrying that you're going to be losing somebody's $80 million.
And because of that, these are the vehicles that then young directors, writers, actors that propel them to stardom. I mean, you think of The Duel, for example, that, a young man went on to make a film about sharks.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, of course, that's a function that TV movies have served for a very long time. You mentioned Steven Spielberg, and Duel was a made-for-TV movie, and yeah, that helped to launch his career. And, of course, the great producer Roger Corman, and director, who is still around, launched any number of major careers.
You write a great essay about the career-starting film for Peter Bogdanovich.
Well, exactly. Targets, which is, I think, a phenomenal movie and an inexplicably all but forgotten movie. He's just one of many filmmakers. Francis Ford Coppola got launched this way. Martin Scorsese got launched way down in the B movie world. So, you know, so many of these people started small and then worked their way up. And I suppose that somebody could sit down and write charts and so forth and show that people who are now making the today's equivalents of B movies, let's say the straight to video quickie that never even gets into a movie theater, some of these people are now showing what they can do, and eventually they'll be making real movies and maybe ultimately real A movies, which, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean better movies. Sometimes people make their little quickie for no money, just as a calling card, because they want to go and make, you know, more Mummy remakes or something in Hollywood. But the directors who really do have something in their soul that they want to express can very often do that best in a B movie, and then maybe they get bigger budgets, but they keep the same passion.
Let's see if we can get some callers in on this conversation. Our guest is David Sterrett, the co-editor with John Anderson of the B-List, the National Society of Film Critics, on the low-budget beauties, genre-bending mavericks, and cult classics we love. And we'll begin with Stephen. Stephen calling us from Cincinnati in Ohio.
Hi. Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
Have you got me?
Yep, you're on the air.
Oh, great. Okay, my vote is for Gun Crazy.
And why is that to your favorite?
Well, I like the way the femme fatale is played, and John Dahl is such a perfect face for the hopeless lover dragged down by the Black Widow. And that long take when they robbed the bank, shot from the back seat of the car, I think is just fantastic.
Would you agree, David Sterrett, Gun Crazy?
Oh, I think Stephen is right on the money with this, yeah. I mean, Gun Crazy is a really perfect example. It's a movie that's really well known to film critics. You know, we all know it and love it and have seen it a million times. But it's really not that well known by the general public, and it really deserves to be. It's an amazing movie with amazing performances, as Stephen pointed out. I mean, John Dahl, who was, let's face it, a terrible actor. Even Hitchcock couldn't make him give a good performance in Rope, gives this out of the clear blue sky brilliant performance in Gun Crazy. And there is this bank robbery scene where the whole thing, the camera stays in the car while the bank robbery is happening indoors, and it's just this long take that keeps going on, and the suspense builds and builds, and part of the suspense is will the scene actually proceed smoothly until the camera runs out of film, or is somebody going to make a mistake and they'll have to film the whole thing over again?
Or could they really not afford to build another set to stage the bank robbery?
Well, all these kinds of problems come up. But anyway, that's exactly the kind of movie that we wanted to call attention to in the B-List, yeah.
Stephen, we'll all go out and rent a copy.
Thanks. Can I throw in Detour as a second choice?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, Detour. Yeah, no, Stephen, again, boy, yeah, where were you? We were putting this book together. Could have used you. Yeah,
I teach film along with literature. I'm an English professor.
Oh, okay, that explains everything. Well, good. Well, I certainly hope you're introducing your students to some of these under-recognized gems. Yeah, by the way, both Gun Crazy and Detour are in the book. And Detour has been called by some people, you know, the greatest or one of the very greatest B-movies ever made. It was shot on almost no money at all. It has a plot that just sort of barely makes sense. It has this sort of atmosphere of poverty and desperation around it as a production, and that's what the movie's about, and everything comes together, and it's just remarkable, and everybody should see it.
Thanks for the call, Stephen.
Thank you for taking my call.
So long. Let's see if we can get, this is Dan's on the air. Dan calling us from Rosslyn in New Mexico.
No, that's Roswell, New Mexico.
Roswell, New Mexico. Well, we have somebody who's was only familiar with Northern Virginia. Go ahead.
No problem. Yeah, you know, no list of low-budget films can exist without mentioning one of my favorites, that being Plan 9 from Outer Space.
And this is a movie famous for being terrible.
Absolutely. I love terrible films. And on the subject of terrible films, there's another one that nobody I've ever spoken to has ever heard of, but I saw it back in the 60s when I was growing up, called Billy the Kid Meets Count Dracula.
Who wins?
Well,
let me tell you how it wins real quick.
No, who wins?
Billy the Kid ends up shooting at Count Dracula, puts 6 bullets in his chest, he doesn't go down, rears back, throws the gun, hits him in the head, knocks him out.
Because it was a silver hilt.
How else could it possibly have ended?
Of course. Threw him in running water. Dan, thanks very much for the call. And
you're welcome.
Your book is really about B-movies that are really good movies, but there is that other category of B-movies that are ridiculously bad.
Well, yeah, of course. And Plan 9 from Outer Space was famously made by Edward D. Wood, Jr., who Tim Burton made a wonderful movie about some years ago called Ed Wood. And yeah, he was famous for making movies with, I mean, you know, we're talking about B-movies here. And, you know, in the minds of some scholars, there's also such things as the C-movie and even the Z-movie. And I suppose that a movie like Plan 9 from Outer Space or the Billy the Kid and Dracula movie would be somewhere down around the, you know, maybe W or X range.
Santa Claus versus the Martians, yeah.
Yeah, all of these, yeah. And it doesn't mean that they don't have their charms. They certainly do have their charms. A lot of these films do. But you're right. The B-list is not so much about the bad movies that were incredibly made for no money and with no stars. They're about the good movies that were even more incredibly made with no money and no stars. And I think that one function of this book is not to make fun of the movies that didn't click, but to celebrate the ones that did.
Here's an email from Terry in Portage, Michigan. I remember in 1976 sitting in the dorm room with some friends picking a movie to go to. Somebody had seen the only other option, so we picked the Rocky Horror Picture Show, even though none of us knew anything about it. We sat there stunned through the opening lips and the rest of the ride. Already by then, there were some costumes in the audience, responses being shouted, and other general Rocky fun going on. For years after that, when I needed an escape, I went to the Midnight movie. I have it on DVD, but it just isn't the same, and my wife doesn't get it. We'll be talking about more films like that, and, of course, immortal rock and roll B-list movie films, like the Buddy Holly story.
Now, get ready, we're going to play some rock and roll!
Say goodbye, cause that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, cause that'll be the day, hey, when I die.
That's Gary Busey. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Eraserhead, The Conversation. We're talking B-movies today. David Sterrett co-edited the new book, The B-List, the National Society of Film Critics, on the low-budget beauties, genre-bending mavericks, and cult classics we love. You can read more about how they pick the films in their book in an excerpt on our website at npr.org/talk. So what's your favorite B-movie and why? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also send us your B-movies on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And David Sterrett, a lot of these movies come into certain categories, and you separate them into categories, including one that seems to fit almost all of them in one way or another, at least in spirit, are B-movies, and those are noir. The one you pick is Kiss Me Deadly, which begins with Mike Hammer, Ralph Meeker, picking up an unknown naked woman in a trench coat.
I'll make a quick guess. You're out with some guy who thought no was a three-letter word. I should have thrown you off that cliff back there. I might still do it.
Yeah.
Where are you headed?
Los Angeles. Drop me off the first bus stop.
You always go around with no clothes on?
There's some guy who thought no was... And that is incredibly a very young Cloris Leachman there.
It absolutely is, yeah. Yeah, they don't write dialogue like that anymore. Well, maybe they still do, but somehow it doesn't sound the same. Yeah, I mean, film noir had to be one of our major categories because so many brilliant B-movies were made in that the great noir cycle, which really stretched through the 40s and 50s. And we've got quite a lot of them in the book. A couple of them have already been mentioned, Detour and Gun Crazy. There's Kiss Me Deadly. There's Out of the Past, Pick Up on South Street.
Oh, Samuel Fuller, one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah. And we've got a good selection of Samuel Fuller in the book. Yeah, Sam Fuller was an astonishing filmmaker,
yeah.
Visually really brilliant. And then we've also got neo-noirs, which we call Nightmares in Technicolor, movies that were made later on and kind of gave a different spin to the old noir ideas. So you have movies like Point Blank and Reservoir Dogs and The Last Seduction. So, yeah, I mean, those movies, which do tend to be very dark, certainly not all the movies in the book are dark, but they are a very major category, and so they kick off the book.
Well, you mentioned Quentin Tarantino, who's made a career out of B-movie homage. And here's a clip from Reservoir Dogs.
Here are your names. Mr. Brown, Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink.
Why can't we pick our own colors?
No way. Tried it once, it doesn't work. You get four guys all fighting over who's going to be Mr. Black. But they don't know each other, so nobody wants to back down. No way. I pick. You're Mr. Pink.
Why do I have to be Mr. Pink?
Yeah, Quentin actually does have that real ear for B-movie type dialogue. And of course, some of his movies are now really major large-scale productions, but in Grindhouse not long ago, which is also in the book, by the way, I think it's the most recent film in the book, he and Robert Rodriguez sat down and made a real not just an homage, but an almost attempt to resurrect the old B-movie genre, which is uneven, I think, in a lot of ways, but it does have a lot of the B spirit to it, including all of the kind of cockamamie phony trailers and things that they throw into the mix.
Here's an email from Ken in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I love B movies. I sure hope you'll include Grindhouse, the great homage to B movies, in your discussion. My wife and I saw Grindhouse at the last Grindhouse in Tulsa. The sticky floors and broken seats made the perfect setting for this movie. There's a certain kind of art film that you really want to see in the Thalia as it was 50 years ago, and the Grindhouse needs to be seen in a Grindhouse.
Oh, absolutely. And I, as a matter of fact, I saw Grindhouse in a very different kind of a setting. I saw it when I was teaching at the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore. So I saw it with a lot of art students. And I kind of expected, it was a real packed house, that everybody would be kind of sitting around and thinking deep thoughts about the visual style and so forth. But, you know, it was almost like being at the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The audience was so interacting with that movie and was so caught up in the excitement and the fun of it. And, you know, with not all B-movies, some B-movies really deserve to be watched in reverent silence. They really do, because they're that good and they're that thought-provoking. But then there are movies, you know, like Grindhouse and a lot of the real original Bs, where being in the audience is at least as much fun as what's going on the screen. The audience becomes part of the show, and that's fun for everybody.
And this is some of the dialogue no doubt everybody who ever saw Death Proof, part of Grindhouse, knows by heart.
You saw my car, I saw your legs. Now look, I ain't stalking y'all, but I didn't say it wasn't a wolf.
So you really weren't following us?
I'm not following you, Butterfly. I just got lucky.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Michael. Michael with us from Mokill in California.
Hi.
Hi.
My favorite is the crown jewel of B-movies, A Creature from the Black Lagoon. And it seems to be a real great thread of B-movies, as the feminine lead is always a woman who's apparently drop-dead gorgeous all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And on that film noir, you haven't lived until you've ever met a tall, blonde, blue-eyed woman who's wearing just a trench coat. That's an experience.
My favorite line, I've always remembered it from Creature from the Black Lagoon, was, how did I get involved in all of this? Science, ichthyology, fish.
I can't even spell it.
You know, there are so many great horror movies that come under the B umbrella, including some of the great 3D classics of the middle 1950s, that we could just get a sampling of them into the book. But, I mean, I love Creature from the Black Lagoon, but, hey, I really love I Walked with a Zombie, for example. And, you know, speaking of horror movies, my great friend Stuart Kluwans, who's the film critic for The Nation magazine, wrote an essay on the sequel to Carrie, The Rage, Carrie 2, which came out in 1999. And I didn't even remember the movie. So I got it from Netflix and I put it on and I looked at it and it is sensational. So, the pure B horror movie can have so much going on in it and can be so much more interesting than the A horror movies these days, which are so completely taken over by special effects.
And
you can't accuse of The Creature from Black Lagoon of being taken over by special effects.
No, that suit's amazing, though. Thanks very much for the call, Michael. and science fiction, again, the difference, as you're saying, between the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and the original, and this is from the 1956 original, at the moment Miles realizes that Becky has been replaced.
I went to sleep, Miles, when it happened.
Oh, Becky.
They were right.
I should never have left you.
Stop acting like a fool, Miles, and accept us.
No. Never.
He's in here! He's in here! Get him! Get him!
Get him. Well, there have been at least three versions of that movie.
Indeed.
And in a lot of ways, the original one is still far and away the best. And, I said a moment ago that there are B-movies that deserve to be watched in reverent silence. I'm not sure if Invasion of the Body Snatchers
is one of them. Yeah.
Excuse me?
Is one of them.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's one of them, but, watching a movie like that from the middle 50s or Red Planet Mars from the early 50s, watching movies like this, the political subtext, what's going on in them, particularly references to the Red Scare and fears about conformity in America and so forth, these themes are expressed and explored so intelligently in these movies that it's really quite remarkable. And then another film we have in the book from the 80s, The Brother from Another Planet, which takes on racism in America in a science fiction context and is also brilliant.
Now let's get Justin on the line. Justin with us from Salt Lake City.
Yeah, hey, how's it going, guys?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to point out that three of my favorite major movie directors these days started out pretty small. Christopher Nolan, Sam Raimi, and even Peter Jackson made Meet the Feebles way back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And these are people who really started off not just in movies that were small, but movies that were crummy, They had no prestige attached to them at all.
Yeah, and I also wanted to know if, coming from you, what the difference is between maybe a B-movie and things that people consider like indie movies these days.
Good question.
Yeah, very good question. And that's one of the things where if there's no more B-movies in the old sense of the low-budget quickie for the bottom half of a double bill, there definitely are equivalents of the B-movie nowadays. And a lot of the indie movies, the independent movies, are just exactly that. And if you think about it, some of the people who still work in independent movies, that is, creatively they're not controlled by the Hollywood studios, are really the equivalent of B-filmmakers. Maybe the best example is Jim Jarmusch, and we have Stranger Than Paradise in the book. But if you look at even a recent movie by Jim, like Broken Flowers, you'll see that he's got bigger names and he shoots in color, but it's still the same sensibility at work. And even somebody like Woody Allen, who gets all these huge stars to work with him all the time, but they work for very little money and he makes the movies cheaply and quickly, and we think of them as art films, but in a way they're the equivalent of the old B art films.
Well, interestingly, you're talking about B movies as sort of a trick of mine, not necessarily a budget. For example, you cite The Conversation is in this book, and that's a film, and by the way, Justin, thanks very much for the call. That's a film made by Coppola right after The Godfather, so he was a pretty hot property, and it stars Gene Hackman right after The French Connection, so he was one of the biggest stars in Hollywood at that particular moment.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we say in our introduction to the book that we took a big tent approach to the B-movie. We didn't say we're going to give you a definition of what the B-movie is, because any attempt to do that would just really be arbitrary. So what we said to the members of the National Society of Film Critics is to tell us what movies that you'd like to write about. And if it doesn't automatically sound like a B-movie, then you got to tell us why it is. You got to tell the reader why it is. And The Conversation is an example, written by the essay written by Peter Peter Keough. And as he points out, Coppola had just made The Godfather, which was making jillions of dollars and, of course, had enormously big stars and was a super major production from Paramount Pictures. And Coppola was pleased with it in a lot of ways, but he hadn't enjoyed making it all that much. And he had ultimately felt that he was basically just kind of making a motion picture version out of Mario Puzo's novel. He wanted to do something that really came out of his own heart and soul. And so he made The Conversation. And yeah, you know, it had a healthy budget and it has, you know, Gene Hackman in it, but doesn't have anything like the resources that The Godfather had in it. So by that standard, relatively speaking, it is kind of a B-movie, and in its spirit of kind of personal expression and not worrying much about the box office, it's very much a B-movie made in between the two fabulously successful Godfather pictures.
We're talking with David Sterrett, the co-editor, along with John Anderson, of The B-List, the National Society of Film Critics, on the low-budget beauties, genre-bending mavericks, and cult classics we love. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. And of course, we can't skip another genre which contributed so much to the B-movie, and that is the Western. Here is Gary Cooper in Man of the West as, well, what else? A former outlaw plagued by his past.
He might give you a little tussle if you let him use his knife. He's pretty good with a knife. Hey, you got a real sharp sense of humor.
Yeah, I was about to say the same thing myself, cousin.
And I think he might appreciate it if you'd let him use that good-looking gun he's got hanging on his hip there, too. He got his juices flowing now. Look at him.
All right, say it all.
Then if you wanted to make it even, you could let him come up on you from behind. He's real fine at that.
They don't cackle like that anymore.
Yeah, you know, the Western is one of those genres that's always dying and yet refuses to die. As we speak, Appaloosa is playing, and it's a wonderful movie with big stars and big production values and a lot of interesting things going for it. But back in the day, there were a lot of Westerns that were made with very limited resources. And Westerns were so hugely popular that the idea was just to get a lot of them out there without always worrying about the details. And what resulted from that were some really interesting and offbeat uses of the Western movie convention.
And some pretty big actors like Gary Cooper, like James Cagney was in a couple of Westerns. You don't think of that. And of course, Randolph Scott, Jimmy Stewart. I think Jimmy Stewart's classic roles are Westerns. Anyway, here's some emails. This from Nick in Mystic, Connecticut. What about Robert Rodriguez's El Mariachi? For someone who's a young filmmaker, this B-movie served as the inspiration to make a good movie on the cheap. If you could please comment on how Rodriguez turned a small budget into an almost legend on low-budget filmmaking.
Yeah, and again, Rodriguez has already come up in this conversation with regard to Grindhouse, which is in the book. And Rodriguez, you know, my own personal view of his secret in his early career when he got launched was that he's just a brilliant film editor. And he can take those little pieces of film and he can put them together into these really kinetic combinations that take something, a scene that maybe doesn't even have a whole lot going on for it, and turn it into something that's really exciting to watch. And he... Again, it wasn't just a trick. It's something that he's been able to build on and have quite a major career, making kind of, you know, mainstream movies as well as the little more offbeat things.
And we're going to let some emailers have some words here just to give them some chance here. Yeah. Tony in Cincinnati, Ohio, my favorite movie of all time is a B-list movie, The Big Lebowski. It is perhaps the most quotable movie I've ever seen. I highly recommend it to everyone I know that loves B-movies. This from Mark in Nevada. My all-time favorite B-movie is certainly Repo Man. From 1985, cheaply made, had a quirky script and sensibility, was funny as hell, and about as weird a film as Americans can make. I try to watch it every couple of months to make sure I remember driving makes you less intelligent and that the life of a repo man is always intense. And here's Mara in Anchorage, Alaska. The Enchanted Cottage, starring Robert Young, Dorothy McGuire, and Herbert Marshall, has it all. An injured war hero, blind pianist who writes tone poems, a creepy and menacing housekeeper who wears all black but has a heart of gold, and an attempt to make Dorothy McGuire ugly with a little bit of pale lipstick and an eyebrow pencil. It's the perfect movie for a cold autumn day. Pop some corn, brew some tea, leave your disbelief and cynicism in a drawer. And I guess that's a true B-movie. We are leaving out, however, but we're going to give one clip of tape from another classic genre, and that, of course, is the war picture. And this is a clip from Oliver Stone's movie, well, Platoon.
Okay, move out in 2-0 mics.
I thought it was O'Neill's turn tonight.
No. Tubbs and Morehouse are short. Pew Shang's going on an R&R tomorrow, and you want to send them out in an ambush? Uh-uh. You got the fresh meat, buddy.
They don't know Barnes, and chances are we're going to run into something. Think about it.
That's just great, Bob. And what do you want me to do? Send one of my guys out to get zapped so some lame ass just in from the world can get his beauty sleep? No.
Clip from Oliver Stone's Platoon. Of course, he's got a new picture coming out. We'll have to see whether it qualifies as a B-movie or not. David Sterritt, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
David Sterritt, co-editor of the book The B-List, the National Society of Film Critics on the low-budget beauties, genre-bending mavericks, and cult classics we love. He's a film professor at Columbia University and the chairman of the National Society of Film Critics, and he joined us from the studios of the Production Room in Santa Barbara in California. Coming up, historian James McPherson on the war powers of the president and the role of commander-in-chief. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.